because of my head injury that I have, I now suffer from a thing called synesthesia, numerical synesthesia, where I can physically feel and taste, and the numbers have a certain color to me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Advanced Engineering Talks, a podcast created by the Advanced Engineering team. A-Talks brings together some of the newest and most innovative minds in engineering and manufacturing to help better the future for our industry. We hope you enjoy the series.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Jeremy Whittingham here, interviewing once again on behalf of Advanced Engineering. I'm delighted to bring you another Advanced Engineering Talks podcast, where innovation never sleeps. My guest today is an advanced manufacturing entrepreneur with a truly inspirational personal backstory. He now operates a 3D printing company and has also drawn on what was a past traumatic and life-changing experience, which has been influential in his life and in the work he does today within the medical and the aerospace sectors. He is award-winning 3D printing pioneer and sometime TEDx speaker, Professor Jason Lang. Jason, welcome. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's great to be a part of this. I really appreciate
it. Lovely. Thank you. Thank you. Jason, you talk around the world, actually, about your experience.
Yeah.
And you often use the title, How We Hacked My Body Back to Life, which is quite a it's a startling title, but it gives a flavor. It really does give a flavor of what you've been through. So I would simply like to kick off by asking you to take us through from the beginning, the background of where you were in life and what happened and how everything changed for you on a human level, and then perhaps, you know, on an innovation level going forward, and how that's developed. But yeah, Jason, please kick off. How did it all begin?
Well, life has a strange way of throwing you a lot of kind of like obstacles. And I think I seem to be the pinnacle of these obstacles being thrown at me, should I say, in a short sentence there, really. So to give you a bit of a background, my background really comes from, I'm actually a jeweler and diamond dealer by trade. And I got involved through winning a few national awards in South Africa into 3D printing back in the early 1990s. So when it was really, really kicking off, I mean, it was only really being used in military stages at that time. And then through the awards, we found a way that we could potentially use 3D printing for the jewelry sector, which involves a lot around metallurgy materials, composites, and then obviously your CAD designs. Having worked around the world after working on ships as a jeweler, involved with different manufacturing processes in the 3D field. When I got back to South Africa, I couldn't get a job because of the field that I was now trained in didn't exist in a third world country such as South Africa. So wow. I ended up having to take my skill sets and go, well, what do I do with my career now? Mm. And I got involved with a maxillary prosthodontist in working out a way to take metallurgy to make custom implants for rebuilding people's faces after oncology, car accidents, gunshots, all that kind of thing, birth defects. So we're able to use in 3D printing together with metallurgy and manufacturing into titanium, as well as the CAD designs directly from CT scans in order to be able to put these people back together. So my skills as a jeweler went into in-depth medical rehabilitation and reconstructive means. Did that for a number of years, and that's when my kind of life really took the most strangest turn ever. So when I was in high school, I used to cycle as an elite cyclist. And when in March 2015, I was training again for the South African championships and on all the velodrome tracks, like you see in the Olympics, right? And there was a freak accident at a very high speed, and I hit the deck pretty hard, and I broke 32 bones in my body, broke 2 vertebrae in my neck, collapsed both my lungs. I broke my clavicle through the skin and broke off. Punctured both lungs, had major brain injuries, and literally passed away at the track. And they worked for an hour to try and bring me back. When they managed to do that, they got me through to the hospital, and then things turned for the worse again. And they eventually put me onto a support machine and told my family the next morning I more than likely won't wake up, but I was going to be completely disabled. And I'll never be able to be completely in a government social home, essentially, in order to be able to live the rest of my days. So I was pretty much written off if I was going to make it through the night. The next day, when they decided to take me off everything, I kind of kept ticking, but then I was put into an induced coma form.
Right.
So I was, yes, I was in and out of consciousness, obviously to check my vitalities and the rest. And that went on for about 2.5 weeks. And then when I finally did come out of that, I was in what they call a semi-locked-in state for about, right, just over about 6.5 months. So when I say a locked-in state, what that actually means is that I knew everything that was going on, but my body would not respond. I could hear everything, but I couldn't. What I wanted to say, what was in my head, was what I was trying to say was not coming out my mouth. I was mumbling. Yeah. I was saying strange things. I didn't have a clue where I was half the time, but I was really stuck in a body that just was not performing. So that's where it all began. And I really, Jason, at that very moment.
Sorry, I was just going to, I was just really curious to ask, can you remember anything of the accident itself or from beforehand? Perhaps not, I'm guessing.
I remember arriving at the track that day and getting changed into my kit to ride. And that's about as much,
right,
as I remember.
Nothing
thereafter. I have no, nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
okay,
nothing. For like, even after, I remember two instances in hospital at one point, and that was one, it's a bit of a laugh actually. They had given me this like, I think it was an orange juice in one of these carton like little tubs, right? And I remember the nurse moaning at me because I was acting like a 5-year-old where I was trying to spray people, not drink the thing. So I was trying to spray it out the straw, trying to spray the patients next to me. And they were trying to tell me to stop doing that. And I was acting like a 5-year-old because I just didn't know what was going on. My body was doing one thing, my mind was doing another.
So
I remember things like that. And I remember being put into the wheelchair to be discharged. And that's about as much as,
right,
I remember of the hospital experience. Wow. Then I was, like I said, I was in a semi-locked-in state. And even that's a bit of a whirlwind kind of journey, because it's a bit of a blur really. But you know, all of this, it comes to a point where I realized that it's what I call it was a very defining moment for me, which I've now labeled the point of friction. And everybody gets that point of friction in life. We know when something goes wrong and you sit there and you go, why me? And that's where a lot of the innovations going forward comes now from this synopsis where I work in. What is your point of friction? So when something goes wrong, everybody goes, oh, why me? Why so bad? Why did it happen?
Yeah, yeah.
But because of my head injury that I have, I now suffer from a thing called synesthesia, numerical synesthesia, where I can physically feel and taste, and the numbers have a certain color to me. So when I think, my mind just works numbers, numbers, numbers all day. But I can literally feel the number and I can almost taste it. So like a number 3 is like a tangerine orange taste. That's very bitter,
wow,
and it's sharp. And I can feel like almost, you can see I'm like almost like at the same time as I'm thinking, I'm like, I can actually feel it in my mouth. It's the most strange thing. So
incredible.
So pictures and numbers became my association of,
yeah,
my world. So because I couldn't really speak, but now all of a sudden I can do these crazy numbers and crazy algorithms. And anything that is all picture related, I can put numbers and pictures together. All of a sudden, I've got a new communicational means. So, you know, with my background being having done the maxillofacial work, the doctor said to me that because of my subclavian artery and my part of my aorta and everything was all mangled amongst the crushed bones and in my shoulder, that more than likely going to have to amputate my arm at some point at the shoulder. Because the way the bones had mangled around the aorta and the rest, they were starting to now obviously restitch and recapsulate, and they were starting to squeeze and tighten up, and I was starting to lose quite a bit of circulation on the arm, and the nerves were starting to die. So they said to me, well, we're going to have to look at amputating your arm. And I was like,
wow.
So I sat there, and even though I couldn't really speak, I told them, I kept on saying, no, 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 I fix me. And I know it sounds like a strange way, that's all the words that I could get out. It was, I fix me, because all I wanted them to do was put me in front of a computer. And because I can understand numbers now and I can understand pictures. So because you think about, what is CAD? CAD design is essentially pictures and numbers. I couldn't read the icons. I couldn't tell what the icons in text were, but I could understand the picture of the icon on the dashboards of the CAD program. And I could do the numbers. So we got a CT scan done of me, and I started to spend the next couple of months planning my own surgeries, planning my own cutting guides, my implants, and how we were going to put me back together, essentially. And that's where the term, how we hack my body back to life, because
right.
Well, I had to get special permission to allow me to do it, but because of my previous history of having gone into theatre with surgeons and performed in such extreme cases, putting people back together, and the surgeons that I used to work with were going to be the guys that were actually operating on me.
Yeah.
We now had a concise means of how we're going to put me back together. Would the average person be able to get this done? Probably not. They probably would have had to jump through some serious hoops. But because we had the credibility and we had the equipment and we had the software and we had the 3D printers, we could actually do simulations of my injuries through on the 3D printers and practice right. surgical runs. Because the problem that I had was because of the brain injury I took, I mean, I had to literally learn everything from scratch again, walk, talk, write, read, how to get dressed, how to brush my teeth again, understand foods, all these things again. But that I could understand numbers and pictures. So even though I couldn't really speak, I could sit in front of the CAD now and actually design my own surgeries because I could understand the algorithms. And this is what we did. And it was like, I think in the beginning, I think everybody just thought shame just to entertain him and just let him sit in front of
humor
the computer.
Him. Right, right.
Yeah, just humor him. Humor him and just let him pass his day. And maybe it makes him happy. But didn't realize, actually, I was now starting to put together a way of putting me back together. Because of the head injury that I took, I couldn't be under anesthetic for longer than 3 hours. So in order to get me through that, we had to find a way that a normal surgery for my shoulder section was going to take 16 to 19 hours. How were we going to get that reduced down to under 3 hours in order to save my arm, right? Yeah. So the only way you do it was to find, you know, using 3D printing processes in a material that matches bone density, like PA6 or PA12 nylon from your HP machines and your EOS 3D printers. And those are good ways of simulating where the surgeons were able to then do the surgical guides and cutting guides and practice how long, how quickly, how long do you draw for, what angle will you draw for, and how do we actually now extract the bone around the arteries and the nerves, and how do we put the implant in and literally drill in place by numbers. But from the time the clock starts ticking when I go under from the anesthetic is, you know, my last on the line, and because it was a very good chance that I might come off the table completely brain damaged to the point that I'd just never be anything again. So my argument eventually, what I said to the surgeons when they said, were you ready to do this? I was like, well, if I'm not going to make it to the table, at least let me have my own fighting chance to do so. Not because we could try, but it didn't work. I wanted to know that I came to the conclusion, like, if I don't get off the table, if I don't make it even off the table, and that's my last days, at least I knew in my heart that I had given my own chance to fight for my own life, like I would do for anybody else's. You know,
and it must have been quite a challenge to get their buy-in for that.
Streaming.
Was it? Remind me again what country this was in. Is this in
South Africa?
This was in South Africa, because I wonder how it might have happened here in a different country. If it were
the regulations and the compliance here in the UK is what makes it a first world country. It is good.
Right.
It's really good. In a third world country, we don't always have the facilities, and sometimes you just have to make a plan. You have to make do. So thank goodness I was there.
Right.
You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, even though the surgeons were limited as far as the new technology, these guys were highly skilled. These are not just, you know, fly by night kind of, and it was stressful for them. And I'll be honest with you, I went through 8 surgeons that when she turned around and said, it's just too risky. We went again and again and again, tried the processes, got to the point that we could feel we could do it. And then we had to sit down and go, is it worth it? Is it worth the risk? And 8 of them turned around back to back, one after the other, and said, no. And it's quite demoralizing when you kind of putting your hope in somebody else's hands and they give it a go and they turn around and say, it's too risky. We eventually had 2 surgeons that knew my background and I had worked with in the past, and I was able to sign a waiver saying that they're not held accountable and it could be used for research purposes for the benefit of other patients. And I thought, well, you know, if it's going to be something and I don't get off the table, at least if it doesn't help me, it will give enough context to help somebody else in a situation like mine. And, you know, when it comes down to, is life worth living? And it's not just always about you. And for me, it was a matter of it's beyond me now. And so with the technology that we've got to come into play, this may set the stage to help save a child one day or an older person.
Absolutely.
When. So I just thought, well, if I have to give up that, and that sounds like a real brag, right? I'm trying to be a hero or something, but it's not the case. It's just really simply, the fact is, it was going to be some benefit of it, at least a beef, not necessarily for me, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
But that's what we did. So we ended up doing the surgery. We got it under 3 hours. And I got off the table. And it was a long recovery. I had a few relapses from the neurological side of things. But having that said, I got to keep the arm. I got about 80% of the arm. I don't really have much feeling. We lost a lot of the damaged nerves in the arm.
Right.
And the implants all fitted perfectly. The engineered bone paste where we used inside me to incubate bone again, all that all worked. Again, I suppose a lot of it might have been a little bit of luck and a little bit of hope and good faith and skills with the surgeons.
Sure.
If I had to do it again, knowing what I know now, probably I can't see why the surgeons turned around and said it was too risky. You know, but sometimes ignorance is bliss, and sometimes maybe that's what I needed.
That's how things, innovation happens again, I think, you know.
But again, point of friction. It's that point of friction.
And taking risk to some extent. Yeah. And I'm guessing that then surely that there were things that have been learned there, as you say, that have now sort of helped to pioneer this kind of work over there, but also perhaps in other countries as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Because during the process, we're not putting me back together. One of our leading ENT surgeons in our capital in Pretoria, he had been working for the last 10 years on how to reverse engineer the tiny little ossicles inside the ear to reverse deafness. And he then approached me during the process because he had heard that I could so-called harmonically tune bone or harmonically 3D print in like nano parts essentially. And during this process, based on what we'd done with the bone paste and the implants, we ended up helping him. And we did January 2019, we did the world's first 3D printed inner ear transplant. They put us in the same category as the first heart transplant in South Africa. And that kicked off. That's what really set the stage on a global capacity. And all of a sudden, I went from somebody that was being brain damaged to someone that was trying to just put himself back together to be normal, to be catapulted with my team and my colleagues to a point of now on a global stage that's now going to really potentially change the world. So the focus went on to how we can stop deafness and all works. And there was a lot of resistance because we came to the conclusion and what we could do quite quickly against normal perils that you would have to go through clinical trials and the rest. And
yes.
Again, this is where advancement of technology allowed us to do this. And the kickback was from people that were still using the standard methods. And that was the challenge. So, you know, we had to overcome a bit of that. And during that process, that then catapulted me to be able to have an opportunity to come across to the UK and explore how we can now take this into a first world country. So that, you know, and once you started doing that, we started realizing, well, this could potentially become something. And then the biggest point of friction for everybody came about now, didn't it? And that was COVID. And unfortunately, it's sad to say, but deafness got shelved. And it was like, what
like
was
a lot
the
of things, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
and,
of course.
And it was a matter of like, now what do we do? You know, what have we done? Everything I've done through, everything I've been through, what was the point? What is it all for? And it was a humbling moment, I must admit, because you start wondering, what is your purpose and what are you here for? And are you here to make yourself look all like, look at me, like Instagram life because you've done all these fancy things in or are you here for a bigger purpose on humanity? And it was a humbling moment to go, well, I'm here to do something for humanity and what can I do regardless of the outcomes? So during the process of being in the UK for the inner ear surgery, we started getting involved with the Graphene Institute and about this fabulous space age material called graphene that I'd heard about so much.
Right.
And when the whole pictures and numbers things comes back into place, we found a way how to what we call functionalize and pre-program graphene to perform a particular function. And when COVID kicked in and we realized that we were going to have to shelve deafness, my colleague Gavin Legan and myself, we then said, well, we need to look at something else. I got then selected for the global talent visa to be able to remain here in the UK, but I had to go back to South Africa in order to be able to get
Right.
In my new visa, in my passport, and the whole works. And that's as COVID kicked off and all flights were being grounded. So I had to literally grab a bag the same day that I heard that we're going to be going into lockdown, hop onto a flight. And there's only like 50 of us on this massive A380 Boeing. And I had the one section to my whole self. And during the way, I thought, well, let me work out a way to create graphene with 3D printing in order to be able to make it smart material to act as a biosensor to be able to detect pathogens, right? Like you do on a normal flight when you're bored. And so this is what I ended up doing. And by the time I arrived back in Johannesburg, I had worked out the math on how to functionalize graphene to be able to use it as a way of detecting pathogens. It was a huge leap of faith because the fact is it was a material that nobody really knew about.
Yeah.
In a way that nobody had ever seen before, in a process that wasn't being seen as a way of testing.
Right.
So I was stuck in South Africa for almost close to 6 months because the flights were grounded. The British High Commissioner in Sheffield and in our capital in Pretoria and as well in the Netherlands all eventually heard about what I was doing, and we managed to actually get me onto a repatriation flight under the Global Talent Visa with some of the British nationals. And I got escorted to, so I actually got there was 8 buses I had to meet at the airport, at the embassy in Pretoria. And we got police escorted to the airport. And I felt like I was being human trafficked, to be honest. I know it's a sad thing, but I felt like it was the most scariest thing ever because we got all hustled together into these buses, expedited to the airport, got off the buses. We had to lay our suitcases out in the road where all the dogs sniffed everything. We got searched in the road outside the airport, and then we got escorted by police onto the plane. And that's how I got back to the UK during COVID. And I thought to myself, that's got to mean something. That means I'm obviously doing something right. Smart materials, 3D printing, making impact in the world. And I'm meeting that purpose. And I was wanting to say, like, it's got to be something to do with humanity.
Yeah.
Arriving back in the UK, we then got cracking on this. And this is where the National Microbiology Framework comes into play. We were then, we saw that there was this national framework on out for tender. We then worked out a way to then collectively make this new handheld diagnostic device that links to your mobile phone. So it's literally bringing a lab on a chip to your house so that we can do pathogen detections at home.
Right.
And we started building that. And then we got selected for this framework based on this new pioneering research that we had done.
Just a note on the national microbiology framework, which you've benefited from. So is that sort of a government funded sort of initiative that awards, you know, monetary awards for research and development? Just a background on that.
So the National Microbiology Framework is broken up into 4 lots. And we got selected for lot number 2 and lot number 4. Lot number 2 is for R&D and development of new devices and diagnostic systems. Lot number 4 was for mass testing. Keep in mind, this is all aimed at COVID at the time. When it
kicked
off.
Right.
It was all about how to do mass testing for COVID, how to do new diagnostics. And that was when the lateral flows and everything kicked off. So we said, well, we're going to go beyond that. And now, obviously, now the COVID so-called scene has been tapering off a bit. It's now gone beyond COVID into everything microbiology, especially around things that are kind of like, you know, how can I put it? It's resistive to medications, and these are new areas that we're exploring within the medical field itself.
Nice.
So it expanded from this. So it's a procurement process under UK HSA in order to be able to bring new innovations into the market. And this is what we got selected for. And then the centralized budget that's got to consign to the NHS Trust and organizations around that.
Yeah.
And so it's not just like you win an award and you have a big lump of cash.
Of
it's not as easy as that.
It's got to link to specific goals.
It's got to go through everything from Cabinet Office. It has to go through to UK HSA. It has to go through trusts themselves. There's a whole realm of collaboratives that come together, including academic research centres, in order to be able to go, what is the big benefit for the general population? And then funds are associated to the research project. So it's not money going into your own pocket or anything. It goes literally into research to pioneer the benefit of the bigger means, really. And that's how we got selected. And it was we were flabbergasted, to be honest, because there were some big players that applied and never got selected.
Right.
So the fact that we came in out of nowhere, got selected, it really set us in the stage. And to the point that we then got into conversations with Microsoft, who then ended up becoming our technology partner. And we brought a whole lot of DevOps guys on board to be able to build this new mobile app that links to your phone, so that the device that we've been building links to your mobile phone to
right.
be able to, so we can start loading different sequences for different pathogens and viruses into the smart device that's partially 3D printed and the graphene's incorporated, and it's all pre-programmed so that the material itself can actually inside the biosensor can start detecting certain pathogens. We're looking to aim to eventually, obviously, detect certain biomarkers for cancer. And, you know, it's just really, it's brought to the table, like, my journey, what I went through on the molecular biology of understanding how to grow bone inside my body again, how to make the 3D printed parts, and how to harmonically tune sound waves and all the rest. These are all things that influence pathogens. And it's now, you know, that's where it comes to the reason of, this is my why, this is why it happened, and this is the purpose. But during the process, I met so many amazing people, and I got to admit, the UK itself has been very accommodating to someone which would have been seen as a foreigner, really. Especially Manchester itself has really, the collaborative mindset of how they pulled me in and worked with me and formed
really?
Hubs around me. It's just, never in
Love
my world
hear.
Have I haven't seen. I used to work on ships. I mean, I've lived and worked in over 72 countries around the world. Nowhere in the world, after being out of sea for 4.5 years, have I ever seen a community come together like I've seen here. And that is a quality that you can't buy. You just can't buy that.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear as well. I think the UK is really strong in terms of R&D and the institutes and universities that we have as well that you were touching on earlier, and of course, as everyone knows, you know, graphene came out of Manchester, and of course the people who did sort of isolate it and identify it, I guess, had actually been from overseas as well and were working in the Manchester Centre. So it is a sort of testament to how open the UK is, I think, in this sort of way. What I think the UK sometimes isn't always so good at is the great ideas over here that we create and work on. Sometimes we could do better with sort of, you know, commercializing them into some of the industry, you know.
Absolutely. Look, the spin-off from what's happening, like your sustainability to meeting like net zero and stuff. I mean, the work that we've done now all has highlighted there's a potential for that from lightweighting into different aspects when it comes to transportation. You know, I think the UK is eventually going to really set its name in stone really here when it comes to innovation, especially Manchester. I mean, I can potentially see Manchester becoming the next Silicon Valley when it comes to new innovations and smart tech, especially around material sciences.
Especially
like low carbon emissions and propulsion technologies. Yeah. These are all things that are going to really set the stage going forward. Manufacturing, I mean, just on the conversations that are coming through from what we've done with this device has now led us into other areas of researching from a material science point of view. And what a bit about it is, it's all going to eventually link back to AI and machine learning, which is the first material that's been able to bridge between analog and digital and bring the data together on a global stage.
Right.
That's really, really, I foresee that going to be like the next big thing for the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's just my opinion, but everybody might have their own say, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting. You now run your organization or company, ProMake. When did you kick that off, actually, then? When was that started, that company?
That was kicked off in 2020, September 2020.
Right.
Because we had to set up purely for the National Microbiology Framework, and it evolved. So when a lot of other companies were taking strain, we were kicking off, which was just the most bizarre experience.
And obviously you've been talking a lot about applications in medical devices, which is obviously key. But I think you also touch on the aerospace sector, or maybe starting to do that. What are there some quite a lot of synergies then that work in terms of, you know, technologies there?
The potential, absolutely. You know, especially because the materials being lightweight and stuff, there's a potential
right.
that you can integrate it into propulsion means, be able to get more thrust out because of the lightweight materials. Also because of the thermoconductivity principles within the graphene, you can actually disperse heat and control heat and cooling. So you'll be able to increase capacity where you haven't been able to control thermoconductivity before. And which it's a combination between lightweighting and thermoconductivity really puts it into a new perspective, which then obviously leads on to it being a low carbon emission product, really. Because it really does make a big difference when it comes to that. You know, if you're going to go even further than that, when it comes to aerospace, especially the big talk about hydrogen technology, and you're able to be able to contain and for hydrogen fuels, essentially, there's a lot of work going on that. Obviously, we're not doing that, but in the areas of the graphene world, this is what's going to be heading up.
Yeah.
So the materials are now becoming a lot more than just its form and just a basic function from a mechanical point of view. The function goes more into a 4D realm in respect to what else can it perform from a sensory point of view, from a thermoconductivity point of view, or in a form of kind of preventative maintenance. And we've never been able to do this with any materials before or any construct.
Right.
So changes the game. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, you've touched on this with what you're saying, I guess, really. But I mean, what do you think are your biggest sort of barriers to going forward from your point of view at the moment in terms of innovation or infrastructure even to move forward?
The biggest barrier is because of that we're working in something that's at atom level and nano level. Sometimes when you can't see it, it's very hard to believe. So getting people to actually understand what we're doing and actually believe what we're doing, unless you're in the industry itself, it's been a tough one. But when they see entities see the end result of what we're able to achieve, it kind of speaks for itself, really.
Yeah.
And so the challenges is it's like any innovation, you know, getting people to actually see what you see and see where it can potentially go. That's always a challenge.
Yeah. And how are you approaching that? How do you try to make those or show that to people to see what you see?
So we're taking a bit of a different approach in this. We can always try and, you know, do this whole like shout out loud and brag about our product like a lot of industries do. But we said, well, we don't want to do that. We want to do informed decision making under a process of education. So we're working a lot with the UTCs, the University Technical Colleges. My colleague Gemma Bethel is leading that quite substantially. And so what we're actually doing is being able to because the UTC is a lot engineering and innovation driven, and that's head up by Lord Baker at the Baker Deering Trust. What we're doing is if we get these kids to understand pictures and numbers and CAD and materials, and we educate them and we create a platform for them. So when they leave uni, or the college, and they go to an institute, they don't go in and go, here's a certificate, I studied such and such. They go, well, here's my certificate, but I bring this infrastructure that can plug directly into your business. And they've already got somebody that can. So there's a bridging knowledge gap we bring to the table. But so a lot of the work we do is a lot of informed education to the customer in order to be able to get an understanding of what is good for them, good for the product, and good for the outcome through the process that we can deliver. Instead of going, here's a product, take it or leave it, really.
You touched on students and education and so on, because we do have, I think we're not the only country to do this, of course, here in the UK, but, you know, there's a general skills gap and there's going to be a lot of requirements for young people to come through and you know, deal with these new technologies and these new challenges. Do you think that's a big issue, a big problem?
Massive, because the kids, you know, especially since we came out of COVID, there's a bit of the lost years there for some of the kids. But during the process, they might be lost in what you and I know is what we got when we went through school, what the process would have been. But during that process, the kids have been able to look at other things from a technology point of view, a learning point of view, a visual education point of view through YouTubes and other aspects. So they might be lost in some ways, but we've noticed such a big speed up in other areas that they are ahead. They've jumped ahead beyond their age, actually, in some stages, because of the fact that they actually grasp things certain ways quicker. So by introducing a digital material that can be digitally monitored or processed in order to be able to make something that doesn't mean whether you're what your gender, race, creed, whatever it is, it really comes down to, do you understand it? You come with a package that can go into any industry. So the skills gap is going to be very tailored to vocational learning. It's going to be very fluid in some way. So would it be the old textbooks like we had before? I don't think that's going to last for very long based on what we're seeing with the kids. The kids are on the fly, kind of becoming very fluid based more on their skills, not on their marks. So the kids are going to be hired for, do their skills set certain criteria based on what they've studied versus what do they get good marks because it was part of the curriculum?
I think that's very important. I think there's still some work to do in the education system maybe to facilitate that. But I think, there are some examples of that happening or at least being appreciated. It needs to happen. I guess as well, it's getting interest at a very early age as well in some of these areas in general as well. But absolutely agree. That's really interesting, Jason. I it seems like an understatement for me to say that was really interesting. It was very inspiring, hugely so. Thanks for a great conversation. I think,
thank you.
You know, it's vital to hear the importance of this sort of experience on a human level as well as an innovation level. I think the latter can't happen without the former, you know, in terms of experience in general. Of course, yours is extremely extreme. It's amazing. Congratulations for how you got through it, really, and
thank you.
Got an amazing, what story? Well, I don't mean story. Amazing sort of new life out of it, and achievement, set of achievements that you're still achieving. And solving goals with for all of us. We wish you continued success and health, and also thank with you. Your company's continued success at ProMake there. I know that you've been a great champion of the Advanced Engineering Show, and hopefully we can hopefully we can still be in touch. Definitely. Will be in touch over the coming year and years to see what you're up to and hopefully showcase some of your innovations going forward, we always want to showcase that at the event. So thanks to you, and thanks everybody who's listening. Thank you. If you'd like to listen to any more of these Advanced Engineering Talks podcasts, we're doing them every month. So feel free to visit advancedengineeringuk.com as well to see what's happening and to look back at some of our previous ones that we've been doing as well. Thank you both, folks at home, and thank you again to you, Professor Jason Lang. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It'll really be enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you.